Good morning. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. You can access our shows live or as podcasts by going online to KUCI.org. This is In the Garden, a show produced by the UC Master Gardeners of Orange County, although today we're up in LA County. I'm DC Morgan, your KUCI radio host for the hour. This week's topic is the Gardens at the Ranch, which is part of the Huntington Library, Art Gallery, and Botanical Gardens. The whole property is 207 acres, but the ranch is about
a half an acre.
And please welcome Cara Hanstein. She is the manager of the garden and the head gardener. Well, please tell us about your background and a little history with the ranch.
Well, I actually went to school for interior design, but that was about 20 years ago, and I've been working pretty much exclusively in the world of horticulture. So I started as a florist and then worked in nurseries
and then
worked in private gardens. And so that's what led me here to the Huntington. And
yeah, because design, you're designing with flowers first.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely been, it was definitely relevant or has been relevant. But I started taking care of the ranch garden actually in 2016. So it's been about 3 years that we've been gardening here. It's been a wonderful experience. It's a really dynamic and different garden.
Yeah, and it's amazing as you're driving up here on the freeway, all the big trucks and a little bit of smog, and then you're in this oasis.
Oh, it's a total oasis.
It's so beautiful. The mature trees are green and all the lush greenery around.
It's hard to believe that this garden is only 10 years old.
Oh.
And it used to be a parking area for the construction of our Chinese garden.
Oh, there's no way you would ever know that.
Yeah. So, you know, we've got some large mulberry trees that have really matured, and a lot of the fruit trees. Actually, some of the fruit trees that were here, that are here, came from the original South Central Farms, which was the original kind of spark for this project here, is that there was a community garden in South Central that the land was sold, and so they brought the trees to the Huntington.
Oh, thank goodness they saved the trees
from this community garden. And so some of those trees are here, and there are a lot of mature trees on this site, I think, which help make it seem like a really... Or it is, not seem, but it is a beautiful, mature garden.
Yeah. When I was here about 3 weeks ago, they gave us samples of the fruit from the mulberry tree.
Oh, that's
I had
great.
Never had that. They were very sweet, very good, and different looking.
Yeah.
They're kind of long and little tiny berries on them.
Yeah, I had never had white mulberries, which, yeah, they have.
Is that what this
here.
Is?
Yeah,
white
that's what
mulberry.
That was there,
okay.
Here. And, yeah, it almost has like a honeydew or peach flavor to it.
Yeah. This is kind of a pretty unknown part of the Huntington as far as I know, but I wanted to go over some of the information that was on the website, which
sure.
It said that this project explores and interprets optimal approaches to gardening in R, which is the LA area, regional ecosystems and climate, mm-hmm. which is semi-arid of Southern California. And it's part classroom, part research lab, and it connects gardeners, native plant enthusiasts, landscape professionals, educators, and researchers throughout Southern California, unquote.
Yeah.
So can you add to that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, every garden is its own microclimate, has its own microclimate, has its, you know, things that are distinctive to it. And so, but we're exploring which edible crops grow well here in the Los Angeles area. So we have things like pomegranate trees. We have the mulberry trees. This is actually a very cold garden, which makes it different than some areas in Los Angeles. So we do have some stone fruits, like apricots and peaches. And, of course, we have lots of fig trees, which do really well here in the Los Angeles area.
Yeah, they'll just pop up like weeds.
Yeah, they do.
Or volunteer. And
volunteer, yeah. But, so, yeah, we're always not a garden that's open all the time to the public, sometimes there's less pressure. And so we can experiment with things. We can just rip something out if it doesn't work and put in a new plant or tree, even though that sounds pretty.
But it's so much less restrictive. That's nice.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but we are open to the public. Not very often, but every Saturday, the Master Gardeners host this garden, and people can come in and learn more and become inspired, or, you know, get their own home garden questions answered by Master Gardeners here.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. The day I came, they had a little salad prepared from what they had grown here, and then of course the mulberry, and it was just very nice.
Yeah.
Nice touch. And they were available for any questions. They had things for the kids to color on the table here.
Yeah, we're really lucky to have the Master Gardeners here every week.
Yeah, good. Yeah, so it's a great field trip for families or anyone, really. Mm-hmm. It's fun, educational, and maybe even a little adventure as you go from garden to garden. So what was the original development of this peaceful place?
The trees came here around 2006, but the garden was developed in 2000 and, or completed, I guess, in 2009. I wasn't here for that, but, you know, I have been told that it was a parking area for the development of the Chinese garden, so the soil was really compacted, so they had to bring in a lot of compost and do some deep spading and lay out the garden. The garden was designed by Scott Kleinrock, and he really did a beautiful job of putting this garden together. There's a lot of little individual, you know, you don't feel like it's only a half an acre. It feels large. And I think that's because there's so many different little areas to explore and wander, and the use of trees where they are. And also it's kind of has little examples of different things for the public, you know, different display gardens kind of within the garden. So we have the native garden, we have a patio garden where we show, you know, the use of recycled materials.
Oh, I have to see that. I missed that last time.
So I think the design of a garden is really has been crucial in having it be a space that feels inspiring for the public.
Yeah, tell me about that recycling garden.
It's actually, it's a raised bed built out of recycled concrete.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and it's in a keyhole shape. And we have planted espaliered apples, and we have a lawn substitute in the middle. We've planted Achillea millifolium in the middle. It's used, you know, basically this garden was designed to inspire, I mean, for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons being to inspire the homeowner to replicate or to do something themselves in their own home garden. And so we wanted to use materials that people could duplicate and use in their own home. So recycled concrete, these simple kind of farm fencing that we have that you can buy at Home Depot or some of the lumber stores.
Sure.
The use of rocks everywhere. So it has a very naturalistic feel to the garden, and there's a lot of curvilinear lines and circles, and so the whole garden is a place to explore, but also is relatable for people in their own home garden.
That's the key word. Yeah,
yeah.
Relatable. And you can copy it. You can reproduce it. Yeah. Now, how did he decide what to put where? I guess sunlight and...
Yeah, definitely the exposure, different areas, is key to selection. You know, this garden, as in a lot of gardens, has had a lot of things planted and removed, and a garden is constantly being worked on and tweaked. And so some of the decisions on plant material, especially with some of the trees, were made by him. But a lot of the softer herbaceous perennials and things like that have just been gardeners selecting plants. And also there's an incredible seed bank because of all the things planted here. So a lot of things just come up on their own, which is really amazing. So there, I think that contributes to it having a very naturalistic feel. So the calendula and the status and the nasturtiums that you see, those come up on their own every year. Mm. Even some of the sweet peas.
Oh, wow.
And owl's clover and California poppies. So the springtime, it's always a very dynamic garden. It's a very seasonal garden. So you can come in at any time of the year.
Yeah, it's different from just 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. And I get that all the time. I tell people, you should come back in every season because it's beautiful when all the deciduous trees lose their leaves. And it's beautiful in the spring when all the California natives are really doing their thing.
Yeah. I'm just mesmerized here. I'm watching the hummingbirds on the near the pomegranate
yeah.
tree, and there's little lizards running around us. We're out in this beautiful patio area surrounded by grapevines, and you just have to come out and visit this place. So I didn't mean to interrupt your thought process. Yeah, particularly since this was such a rainy year, the super blooms, as they call it, which brings out the super life of everything around here.
Yeah, definitely. It was a rainy year, which was really beautiful for the garden.
What's your favorite section of the garden?
That's a hard one. I like how all the sections integrate and play together. You know, and it changes from season to season. So right now the native garden is really beautiful. I love the vegetable row garden because that's where we get to change things out, see what works. And that's also the section that is really important for our school groups that come through.
Oh, yeah, you do have a lot of school children mm-hmm. that visit and the teachers and then Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. Do they help? I think they help you out here. I think
they do periodically. We get Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts that have like their Eagle Scout projects. And so they have done sheet mulching, which is where we take cardboard and lay it down on the soil and put mulch over it. So they've sheet mulched the orchard. We had a Girl Scout who built a mason bee house.
Oh, is that the one with the little holes?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And so, they've helped up here. We also have high school volunteers that work up in this garden every Sunday. And so I work with them and they come from local schools in the area and, get their hands dirty. They love it.
Yeah, I'll bet. Who wouldn't? It's just so beautiful here. What kind of California natives are you currently growing here?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a lot. We're working on getting our signage kind of going really well in this garden. And so I had a huge list of natives and other Mediterranean perennials. But Lepicinia fragrans is a really nice one that we have growing. It's called San Diego Pitcher Sage.
Oh.
And I'll show you some. It smells delicious.
Okay. Does it get quite large?
It gets to about 3 feet. I think it can get a little bit taller, but 3 feet is about average. Has a really fragrant leaf, can grow well in kind of dappled light and underneath oaks, and can take full sun, so it's pretty versatile. We have a lot of the different salvias, the Clevelandii. You can see that the Onothera elata, the evening primrose, is everywhere with the yellow flower. That's kind of been an invasive plant. We just put in a couple of them in the garden about 3 years ago.
And now it's a forest.
Yeah. And I guess that's a host plant for the white-lined sphinx moth. So we've got caterpillars all over the garden right now.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about that caterpillar. Pillar you were telling me on the ride up here.
Yeah, so it's we have them and they're just devouring the plants, but it's, you know, there's enough plant to go around, and it's a beautiful sometimes it's referred to as a hawk moth or a hummingbird moth, but we have caterpillars right now in various stages, so it's been really cool to show kids, and the volunteers that came in on Sunday are the ones that discovered them, you know, so they were taking photos and, you know, looking up what it was.
And then how do you put into process your sustainability ideas?
Mm-hmm. I think the whole garden, just the design of it and the maintenance of it is sustainable in its approach. It's thinking, because it's a very integrated garden with, you know, fruit trees and vegetables, but also lots of flowering perennials throughout. Everything's kind of growing together. So it's kind of an ecosystem approach to gardening and laying out we are encouraging those beneficial insects and the lizards and all this life that you're seeing, you know, is drawn to this garden because it's all been planted. But, you know, we do a lot of, like, the sheet mulching that I referred to before.
Yes.
A lot of mulching to build the soil health, you know, so thinking about the soil health is, you know, key for this garden.
You have to start there.
Yeah, and so, you know, making sure that we're promoting those bacteria and mycorrhizae connections with the plants is key.
Yeah, that fungi is amazing.
Yeah.
We talked about it on other shows. We mentioned the word all the time, mycorrhizae fungi. It is so important, and it's a white filament type substance that goes, fungi, I should say, that makes a web and goes out around the plant roots. And it helps, it brings back to the plant nutrients that the roots can't reach and water. So it helps the plant become more drought resistant. And it's a symbiotic relationship because the fungi then gets carbohydrates from the plant when the plant goes through photosynthesis and produces carbohydrates. That's what the fungi wants. So the plant gets the nutrients and more moisture and more nutrients, and the fungi gets carbohydrates. That's why we call it the symbiotic relationship. It is critical. And yet sometimes it looks like kind of a white.
Yeah, you'll see underneath even the cardboard or mulch, even if you just do mulch straight onto the soil, you'll see the fungal hyphae kind of forming underneath it really quickly, and it kind of looks like white, I don't know,
filament.
Tenuous, yeah, you know.
And normally, a few years ago, I would have gone, ooh, get rid of it, you know, but it's so needed in the soil.
Yeah, so our garden, the soil is really kind of like spongy because it's got a healthy balance of the microorganisms, but also the oxygen in the soil. We don't compact the soil by walking in the beds constantly. We try to garden from the outside in the pathways.
That's a good tip for our audience.
Yeah. So you don't want to tromp all over your soil, you know, after the rains. And even if you do, you know, having that healthy layer of mulch, you know, will help reduce kind of some of the compaction, but you're always adding new organic material to the soil and respecting the soil as a living organism.
Now, tell us about the different fruit trees you have here.
Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of, bordering the whole garden is a hedge of citrus. So we have three different types of blood oranges.
Mm.
We have kumquats, we have navel oranges, we have caracara oranges, we have some mandarins and tangelos. So we have a lot of citrus that comes to fruit in the winter. And so if you come to our open houses during the winter time, you'll get your dose of vitamin C.
Yeah, I can see the kumquat right there, right?
Yeah,
right
back. Yeah.
It's loaded.
Yeah.
And that's not an Akami, is it?
No, that one's not. I don't remember
it's
which
bigger.
Variety it is.
Yeah, as far as I know, there's two kumquats and the Nagami, which I have at home,
uh-huh.
But they're much smaller than those. But I love them. I eat it, the skin and all.
Yeah. We have a lot of these ones right here are the miwas.
Oh, okay.
And the miwas are a really sweet kumquat, so they're not as tangy as some of
the
other
ones. Oh, I like the tartness.
Is really nice.
Yeah.
We have a lot of different types of pomegranate trees on site, lots of figs. Fig season is really popular because we have a variety of figs. We have the Codota, which is like a green fig. We have one that's called Violette de Bordeaux, which is a sweeter, dark purple fig, more of a dessert fig.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah.
We have one called Excel, which is a really nice green fig. I really like the taste of that one because I don't like the too sweet. So some of the purple ones are a little too sweet for me. It's a green one that's kind of mildly has a nice honey kind of flavor to it. That's the Excel
fig. Do you see that in the market much, or would it be a specialty market?
I don't think you see a lot of figs in the market in general, just because they don't hold very well. Sometimes during the season, you'll see them for a flash of a few weeks.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that one.
All right, now what about vegetables? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the vegetables, we kind of have our two seasons, really. Well, our four seasons, but we plant our winter crops in the fall, and so we grow a lot of, you know, things in like the brassica family. So we have kale and broccoli and cabbage, and we grow bok choy, peas. So lots of winter crops.
You start in September, October?
Usually October.
Okay.
Yeah, October. And then we had huge Swiss chard this year. I mean, it got to about 3 feet. They were gigantic.
Dinosaurs.
Yeah, and in the fall, we brought in a few yards of compost and amended those row crops with compost. And it worked out well in this season. In the end of March and early April, we planted kind of some of our spring and summer crops. We've got planted tomatoes, eggplants, beans, which I think we put in a little early because it's been so cold. They're not really doing much. I mean, they'll probably start to shoot up as the weather warms. We have onions and garlic that we planted in the fall, so they take a long time. Okay. So I now have new respect for garlic and onions that I buy in the store.
Yeah.
How long they have to be in the ground.
Where do you get your compost? Do you make it here? Or
We actually do. We have a small compost, well, a couple compost piles that are right behind you that we built with the high school volunteers. It's not ready yet. We did buy in our compost this year. And then we also do worm composting. So that's our worm bin right there.
Oh, great.
And we do that with the high school volunteers again. You know, get the worms and put in, we use coconut core and mix in a little sand and, make the mix and start feed. Actually, a lot of the food they get are from the open houses on Saturdays. They get the leftovers. Yeah. So we do a little bit of composting. Well, we do some composting here, but it's not enough to kind of feed our big 80-foot plot here what's needed.
Yeah.
It's been more of an educational tool.
What's that thing with the water? It's like a water filter.
Yeah, so that's a new aquaponic system that just got installed last week. Yeah, it's really exciting.
It's a new hydroponic system.
Yeah, okay. Hydroponic system. So we're going to be growing vegetables in the clay pellets, and then it's a circulatory system, so there's water circulating from that large bin. And it's feeding down into where the clay pellets are, where we're going to be growing vegetables and then recycling. The vegetables are like a biofilter that filter out the water, and it goes back up into where the fish are. So the fish's, you know, waste is returned to, you know, to the plants. To
like a fertilizer?
With nitrates,
oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And then recirculated.
So there's fish in there?
Not yet.
Oh, there will be.
It's that new. So okay. The system just got finished getting installed a few days ago. And so we're going to be putting koi, baby koi in there.
Okay.
And so that'll be our koi nursery for the Japanese and Chinese gardens.
Oh.
Because that, I guess...
multi-purposes.
Yeah, multi-purposes. And so it's a simple system that we hope will inspire people to try it at their own.
Yeah. Those little round things, they look like they're organic, but they're clay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, I actually don't know much about the makeup.
They look like a hazelnut shell or something. But, it's a brand new system. It's spanking clean new.
Yeah.
And this caught my eye when I first got here. It's really interesting.
And it's solar powered because we don't have electricity up here.
Oh, now that's interesting.
Yeah, so the pumps that keep the water circulating are powered by the sun, and our irrigation up here is actually solar powered as well. We have a solar powered system that turns on the valves and waters our landscape, so all the area that's surrounded. Yeah, I'll show you the system. It looks like a little parking meter.
Modern technology is amazing. So is it all drip, or do you do those few little sprinklers?
Yeah, we have both. We have drip and we have spray heads. And then we also have areas where we manually water with broadcast rain birds. So that's three different methods of irrigation. But again, because we do have done, you know, in the course of the 10 years, so much mulching, you know, the soil really retains moisture really well. And so the amount of water that we have to put into the gardens is pretty minimal because of the soil health.
Great to hear. Now, how hot does it get out here in the summer? Because that would probably have a lot of evaporation if you didn't have all this mulch on the ground, right?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because this garden, I mentioned how cold it gets during the winter, but it also gets really hot during the summer. It almost becomes hard to work in. I don't know what the temperatures have maxed out at, but I know last summer we had that July 6th date, I think, where it got to like 116 degrees or
yes,
something.
Yes, the same
insane.
In Irvine, and it fried a part of my, I have an Aurelia tree. It's a tropical tree. Uh-huh. Never had a problem with it. Just grows by itself. I don't fertilize it or anything. and it fried about a quarter of the branches.
Oh,
yeah,
that's
so we just stopped taking off the last of the leaves. They were like with a torch. It was like because it had never gotten that hot before in Irvine.
Yeah, it's going to become increasingly important to take care of the soil for these to have the plants kind of muscle through these hotter periods. Because I'll tell you, our avocado tree here did not suffer from that heat wave.
Oh.
And it's got a ton of mulch and also natural mulch from the leaves that fall off of it underneath it. And I've seen other areas where the avocado trees really were scorched from that heat. So.
That's good for the homeowner to know.
Yeah.
That's one of the main questions we get on our hotline, which tells us that the main interest is usually avocado, strawberries, and citrus
trees.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What materials do you use in your vegetable bed? Like I heard you did some straw or a straw experiment?
Oh, yeah. So in the past, we've done straw bale gardening, which worked out really well. And it's a little bit of a process to get it going. Not a process, but you have to water them really well for a few weeks and then add fertilizer and kind of get them cooking before you plant them. But we did straw bale gardening. Right now we're kind of doing more of just a traditional row garden where it's planted in the soil that's amended with compost just so people can. It's just basically how much vegetables can you get going in an area that's, 75, 80 feet wide and, kind of maybe a backyard scale garden.
Perfect. Perfect for the home gardener to know. Yeah, and you have raised beds too, you said, didn't you?
Yeah, so we have a couple of, there's four raised beds over there where we do different experiments, and it's our experimental garden. So when we first, a few years ago, came into this garden, we removed a tree and we kind of created a nice area where the exposure was even throughout, because we knew we were going to use that for research experiments. And so we have, we've done different things where we test like fertilizers against each other, different types of fertilizer, Bat Guano, Dr. Earth. We tested different compost methods against each other, so regular compost tea versus worm compost tea versus the weed teas that you hear about where you take in. Create teas out of different weed grains. And so it was interesting. What went out with that one was the worm compost tea.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
I'll bet. That's good to hear. It reconfirms how much they're promoting worm tea.
Yeah.
That's
and then
good.
What went out with the fertilizers was the... And when I say went out, I mean there was... It was slight differences in how the plants looked and the size and the production. So it wasn't like a landslide or anything.
Okay. It was only slight.
But yeah, it's kind of interesting. We wanted to see if there would be
a big difference.
Yeah.
And there wasn't.
Yeah. And then, so right now we're just doing something simple where we're just growing the garden completely from seeds directly sown.
Mm.
So just to, show people that you can just take a seed and start a vegetable. You get so used to going to the nursery and getting starts. And
yes, I planted dill yesterday.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and I was surprised. Their seeds are pretty big.
Oh,
bigger than
okay.
I thought they would be.
Yeah, it's always cool to see. Yeah, we just planted bitter melons, and those have a really big, hard shell. You have to nick it with a knife.
Oh.
Yeah. So we've never grown those here before. So everything kind of is, gardening is an experiment, right?
Yeah, it is. It's an ongoing.
You're always learning. And
the practice of gardening, like the practice of medicine. It's a practice. You have to get into it. Okay, let's take a little moment here for our station identification. I want to let everyone know that this is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. If you want to know more, you can go to kuci.org online. Okay, so we were talking about the different experiments going on here.
Yeah, we also have another experiment that we've been working on with the high school volunteers, which was actually brought to this garden by a master gardener named Lydia Breen, and she got this experiment funded by NOAA, And
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's analyzing soil health and climate change. And so what she's done is, with our high school volunteers, is we planted out rows. We designated part of our row vegetable garden to this experiment, and we planted them out with fava beans, inoculated different methods, molasses, the inoculant that they give you, the bacteria inoculant, just regular fava beans. And then we had rows without any fava beans, and then we follow that fava bean planting. Once we knock it down, we cut it down and let the... So fava beans have the ability to actually pull nitrogen from the air and store it in the root systems in these nodules.
Interesting.
And so they're nitrogen fixers. They build the soil. And then also the carbon is sequestered in the soil from the roots, you know, here. And so we left the roots in the soil and then let it decompose. And then we followed that planting with corn. And so we have corn planted right now. It's just a few inches tall, but we're going to see if there's any visual difference in the health of the corn, how much is produced. And we're also monitoring the water, because when, you know, you improve the soil, you also improve the soil's capacity to hold on to water.
Oh, that's true. So, that's so important to know. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's an experiment that we have going on.
Now, okay.
It's the National Atmospheric.
National.
Oceanic. Atmospheric, yeah.
But they're the ones you can go on their website and these big maps that show where the storms are.
Yeah. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Okay, so they're a big, important federal department. And
yeah.
That was great that she was able to get them to get
exactly.
behind this.
So they're interested in exploring this connection between soil health and
climate change.
Yeah.
We're definitely in the middle of that. I can see how, as we walk through and we take a closer look, and the same when the school children or anyone comes, that it gives you a deeper understanding and respect. Like you said earlier, you respect those farmers, what they have to do now to grow certain fruits and vegetables and to maintain the plants.
Mm-hmm.
I just, again, would encourage people to come out and walk around, especially, well, on a Saturday. It has to be Saturday because that's the only day they're open.
Mm-hmm. We do have a lot of school groups that come through the ranch, and so we actually have an education program called Seed to Table that works with second and third graders in the Pasadena School District.
Oh, that's
and
great.
And they come here every Wednesday and Friday, different classes, and they visit the orchards, they visit the nurseries, and they visit the ranch so that they can see their food growing in under different applications and kind of learn to... They understand how their food is grown and that whole process of from a simple, you know, from a tiny seed, their food comes. And also the you know, they learn about pollinators and pollination, you know, especially up here at the ranch. As you walk through, there's so many different butterflies and moths and bees and, you know, and flies.
Birds.
And so they get a real holistic understanding of how things work.
Yeah, and I noticed a few bunnies are hopping around too.
Oh yeah, that's why we have all the farm fences around the vegetables.
That is funny. People can call in advance if they have a group and
have a lot of college groups that come through from our local colleges here, and I mean all the way over from, you know, Santa Monica and Pasadena. We have different groups that come through. Garden clubs will visit the garden. So it gets a lot of action, and it's great.
Well, is there anything that you would like to share that I haven't listed here that you'd like to share with our audience?
The main goal of the garden is really to inspire people to get out and to get into their own gardens. And I think that this place is really inspiring because you can see how regenerative nature is, and within, you know, 10 years it's gone from parking area with nothing growing but an oak tree to this really lively oasis that's, you know, special for so many people. So I think that inspiration is kind of the key.
The goals here.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's so important. You're so lucky to be a part of it.
Yeah, I do feel lucky.
Tell us about the Master Gardeners, how they interact with you.
actually, we have, the Master Gardeners have a person who manages their time here, and her name is Emmy, and her and I meet on occasion to kind of just get updates on what's been going on in the gardens, so they can kind of, when people have specific questions about the garden itself, they can be tuned into what's going on. But the Master Gardeners come every Saturday, and they host the open house, and they lay out books and food for people to eat, and are really just a lively and important resource for the homeowners and students and whoever comes through. They also help out with the Seat to Table program that I was telling you about.
Oh, yeah.
They walk students through and tell them about the ranch, and so it's, we're really lucky to have them.
So tell us about the flowers that are here.
Oh, well, we have a really floriferous, is that a word, garden right now, especially. But, there's different things going on at different times of the year. But right now we have a lot of California poppies and different Clarkia and status and wild, kind of things that contribute to having it look like a more wildflower environment. We've got lots of calendula, which drops, if we could go over and look at them, they have so many seeds that they reseed like mad. But also, and you come during early spring, late winter, and all of the fruit trees are flowering.
Mm.
And so it's really, there's always something flowering here is what I usually tell people. They're asking about what time of the year they should come visit the ranch. There's usually always something that's in bloom and of interest.
Yeah, that Clarkia, we don't see that so much in Orange County.
No.
But I took a field trip up here, and we did a California Native garden tour.
Oh, okay.
And many of the homes had that Clarkia.
Oh, okay.
And it was quite tall.
Yeah, yeah. They'll reseed themselves, too, if you introduce them into your garden. Same with a lot of, the sweet peas that you see. And there's another one called Phacelia, which the native bees just really love, and we have that planted in the garden. That's another question that we get a lot from people where are the honeybees? Do you guys have hives? But we really try to inform people about the native California native bees. There's like 1,600 different varieties in California, and they're just as active pollination. And
as the European honeybee.
Yeah, as the European honeybee. They're different. There are a lot of them are solitary and live in the ground or live in, wood holes and.
Mm-hmm. I was amazed to hear that.
Yeah.
They'll live in a little log or something.
Yeah. So we have, you'll notice, with the native plants, so much more life on them than your other, plants from different areas. I mean, you plant it and they'll come.
good. Yeah. That's why we need to be planting more California natives.
Yeah.
Get the land back to what it was. So then that brings the right insects and the right butterflies and moths and then the birds and just the big picture.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people that get not a lot of people, but sometimes people get discouraged because they look ugly during certain times of the year, but really it's such a short stint. It's like it's a couple months where they look a little scraggly. You don't water them, and they're really quite durable. And I think they're more durable than their reputation. Sometimes it can be difficult to get them started. They can really, take, some of them can take more water, but they're either, the highlight is that they take less water, but they're really tough plants.
Yeah, you just have to be patient and let the root system get established and then let them go. And
yeah,
but you're right. They can look pretty bad a couple months of the late summer, early fall type.
Yeah,
thing.
But that's why I think, in a lot of our, in that front part of the garden that we call the low water perennial walk, that has a lot of Mediterranean salvias and things integrated in the planting bed. So that there's always kind of, during the season when maybe the natives are looking a little dry, the other things are kind of holding down the show.
Yes. Do you have any hummingbird sage?
We do. Yeah, we have a lot of the salvia.
I love that one.
Yeah, so that, that salvia is actually used a lot by the master gardeners on Saturdays. They put it in the water that they serve to the guests.
Oh.
Yeah, and it really is, you just need a little bit, just a couple of leaves to add to your water, and it just gives it kind of a little bit of a fruity,
herby,
sagey,
fruity.
Herby, yeah, flavor. It's really lovely. Yeah.
I love the red, and sometimes they go a little on the pink side, but, mm-hmm. and they can be planted under trees.
Yeah, so those are great to plant underneath oaks. The first time I ever saw that plant, most of the plants I know from a nursery, but that the first time I ever saw that plant was on a backpacking trip in the wild. And what is this? You know, there were these huge hummingbird sages. They were like 3 feet tall.
Were they in bloom?
And they were in bloom, and they were in dappled shade, dry, underneath an oak tree. They looked great.
Yes. We saw some of those down in a park called Riata Park down in San Juan Capistrano.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, that park was planted by Tree of Life Nursery, which is our only really big native plant.
Yeah,
like you have the Theodore Payne up here.
Yeah.
But we have the Tree of Life in Orange County.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's where we send people when they...
Have you interviewed them before?
We have, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't on the team at that point, but yeah, Mike Evans is the owner, and he's always helpful to everyone.
Yeah, he's wonderful, and I have gone down there.
Okay, you've been down.
Yeah,
okay.
I've been down because we, you know, started incorporating more natives throughout the Huntington, and we went on a trip down there to check out their inventory because we knew we were going to be, using them to introduce different plants here on site. So sometimes I forget that as a gardener, it's really important to get out and see different things like nurseries and go on hikes and camping trips.
Because
seeing those plants in the wild or seeing them in the nursery, it helps really just inform how they work in your garden or can or don't. And it can be interesting. I remember one time on a hike encountering Trichostemma, that woolly blue curl.
Oh, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Yes. The smell of that is so divine. Yeah.
It is. I can't even, to me, it smells like Christmas. It just has this kind of piney, it's amazing. But yeah, it was growing in Tujunga on like a south facing hillside. Needs really good drainage. And I was like, that's why we keep killing them, because we've got them on drip, getting weekly watering, So I cut the drip line on the trichostemmas and, they ended up doing better. So getting those outside experiences can really help you as a gardener.
Yeah. That, which is the woolly blue curl, is the common name, and the hummingbird sage, those are two of my favorite ones.
Yeah.
They're really, really good ones. So have you been to Theodore Payne?
I have, yeah.
I still have to go there. I mean, we went to we took a stop there, but we didn't have time to go in the garden, so
yeah.
I know where it is, in Sunland, but...
Yeah, it's in Sunland. I grew up in that area, and so I've been going there for a long time, but I haven't been there actually since they have, like, a new education center. They've done a lot of development of that nursery.
Okay, I'm sure some of the plants may have come from there too.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I did an interview at the Tucker Wildlife Sanctuary, and Madame Majeska's home was right next to that, and she had Theodore Payne come out and do.
Is that in Santa Barbara?
No, it's down south. It's inland from Lynx, Mission Viejo, Santa Ana, that area. And it's in Santiago Canyon, Silverado Canyon area.
Oh.
She was so ahead of her time. She was in the 30s, and she was into the native gardening and beehives. And so she had Theodore Payne come down and plan out a garden for her.
Oh, so he designed her garden?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There is a tie-in with Orange County.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. See, what else do we need to cover today? We have about 5-10 minutes to go. Do you get out and get to see the other parts of the Huntington garden?
Yeah, I actually, I also am responsible for the children's garden, which is just, it's pretty close to the ranch garden, and it's a more formal garden that's kind of really beautifully designed for children to run around and explore. It's based on the four elements, earth, fire, air, and water.
Beautiful.
And so there's lots of water features, and it's completely enclosed, so kids can't escape. You know, parents don't have to worry. They can kind of just run around and explore, and they're beautiful weeping mulberry trees that they can sit underneath. Mm. And there's a little cottage that's made out of fig vine.
Ooh.
And, yeah, so it's a little green building.
Organic building.
Yeah, organic building in the middle of the garden. And, yeah, so it's really wonderful to have that garden so close to the ranch, because on Saturdays we do get a lot of families that come through. And so, like you said, you saw the master gardeners with coloring pages out for the kids. We get a lot of kids that come in and experience the garden.
Yeah, and I saw the gardener. He was clipping a hedge into, or a shrub into a turtle.
Yeah, so we have lots of topiary art in the children's garden. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, I can't forget about that. There's lots of animals that are made out of.
Yeah, and he was being very precise, because we came in the morning. He was getting started. At the end of the day, he was just finishing it up. So it took him all day to do one or two shrubs.
Yeah, it takes a long time to
piece of art.
Yeah.
Sculpture. Sculpture with pruners.
Yeah, really. And then, so I do get around to the other gardens, and then... And I think sometimes not enough. Sometimes you get into your zone of your little areas at the Huntington, but it's good to get out and really value all that we have here. Like, I always tell myself I need to get into the galleries and see some of the artworks more.
They're amazing. Mm-hmm. I still have not been in the library. I need to go, and I've been there several times, so I'm going to do that very soon.
Yeah, it's easy to get garden-centric, but there's a lot here.
Yeah. And what about the herbarium?
They are taking leaf samples a lot and have a collection of the plant cuttings, but I don't personally
I'm going to tell the audience about what the website says about it. And it's an exotic plant depository, which aids in research and identification. It's mostly exotic plant specimens used in research and teaching, and the purpose is to serve as documentation for these research projects. Got over 10,000 species, and it's an archive of vascular plants from around the world, particular emphasis on Mexico, Central America, and South America. The plant families are well represented, which are desert plants, basically, from worldwide. Interestingly enough, the herbarium receives and provides loans of plant specimens used in active systematic research.
Yeah, so there's, this garden here doesn't have a lot of what we call collection items. Some of the fruit trees are collection items, but a lot of the gardens, the plants are part of our art collection. And so a lot of those plants are collected and saved, and we have plants from all over the world.
Yeah, it said there's like 5,539 identified species, so that there's, 30% they haven't identified yet. Mm-hmm. 200 families, 1,000 genera, 2,200 species. It's just a lot of research going on there.
Yeah, we have a few botanists that work.
Yeah. And then it said in 2009, the Huntington received the Pasadena City College Herbarium, PASA, on permanent loan.
Oh, wow.
And it encompasses roughly 3,000 species, which those other numbers would add up to, mostly collected in the early 19th century in North America. And then in 2010, the D. Lobenfels Research Collection was donated to the herbarium, representing one of the finest research collections of Southern Hemisphere conifers in the world. For the conifer lovers out there, there's that too. Well, I think our time's about up, and I just have really enjoyed our conversation and getting to know you and all these wonderful plants.
Me too. Thank you for visiting.
Yeah. Is there any final words you'd like to give to our audience?
Well, I just hope that this inspires people to get out into their garden and to teach the children about gardening.
Yeah, appreciate where the food comes from and love how we can interact with all of nature. All righty. Well, thank you, Cara. We only touched on a bit of what there is to see and do at the Huntington Library and Botanical Gardens. I wanted to just give a little summary of some of the other gardens and things to see. artwork. They have four places to view art: the library, the house, which is a huge mansion. It's beautiful. Elegant staircase, which is kind of fun to walk up and down. The Scott Galleries and the Boone Gallery. And then, of course, the library, which is really renowned for one of the Gutenberg Bibles and many other manuscripts and things to see, as well as art in the library. And that's a separate building. And then the gardens. There's 16 themed gardens, which is over 207 acres is in total, but the gardens, the 16 themed gardens, is 120 acres. They have tours. They have a rose tour, Chinese garden tour, Japanese garden tour, Mediterranean plants, children's garden tour, and some of the collections that they have are bonsai collection, camellia, cycads, and orchids. They have group tours, school tours, audio tours, which be sure if you go as an individual to get the headphones for the audio tour. And they have classes and workshops. So everything is on the website. It's thehuntington.org. Check it out. It'll take a few minutes. There's so much to see and do there. It'll take a few minutes to go through it all. I also wanted to mention they have a free day. The free days are the first Thursday of each month. However, there's not going to be one in July because it's July 4th, Independence Day. But you do have to have a ticket, so you go online to thehuntington.org, get your ticket, and the good thing is the parking is always free. So from Orange County, it does take a little while to get there, but when you get there, the parking is free. And if you go on the first Thursday of the month with a reserved ahead ticket, the entrance also will be free. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next Thursday, 8:30 to 9:30, in the garden.